Well, welcome back to This Week in the Association. I'm Rob Pinheiro, joined once again by my good buddy Kevin Lucco from the 10th inning stretch. And Kevin, it's been a few days since the championship series over, but I'm assuming that you're still basking in the glow at this point.
You know, reality has finally started to set in now. The festivities have wound down. The 1-minute parade was on Monday morning. Saints are honored at Target Field. But George Stammons threw a nice strike for the first pitch. It wasn't one of those, the charity ones where they just lop it in. George stood on the pitching rubber. It looked like a nice little breaking pitch right down the heart of the plate, like he was auditioning for a spot in the Twins bullpen. But that was really cool that when Saints got introduced to the crowded Target Field before the game on Monday night, when you consider back in 1993, the Twins wouldn't have even let the Saints in the door to the Metrodome. It goes to show you how long how far the teams have come along as far as becoming good neighbors.
Well,
and a real nice touch I thought was Max Murphy was back in Minnesota after winning a ring in the California League with Visalia. And he had Max Murphy join his former Saints teammates, and Max Murphy was also among the Saints that were recognized at Target Field.
Well, that's pretty cool. So, you know, a guy who was the MVP until he wound up getting signed. So that's pretty awesome. So,
yeah, I'm hoping he should get a ring too, if you ask me. And I got a feeling he will.
Well,
then Tuesday night, George Stammons and Blake Schmidt were introduced to the XL Energy Center crowd during the Minnesota Wild preseason game. So that was also a nice touch by the Saints crosstown neighbors.
Wow, look at that. So good to know the city's kind of pouring out and recognizing a championship team there, because other than the Lynx, I don't think there's been one in the Minnesota State since, what, 91? Is that what we're talking about?
Right.
Yeah, so 2004 with the Saints, obviously, but not a lot of great news going on these days in Minnesota in terms of sports champions, so awesome.
No, we're reestablishing ourselves as Loserville. The Saints were also on a local television show, Twin Cities Live, on Monday, so hey, it's the Miles Wolf Trophy is getting some mileage since it was acquired by the Saints on Saturday night.
Well, it's good to know that the city's embracing that, because the crowds obviously come out and it made a big deal. But you know, I think we've seen from local press that it's been, you know, they'll come out for the first game of the season, they'll come out for maybe like the first game of the playoffs, but after that, it's just, you know, nobody really seems to care from the local media what's going on. And it's like, it's good to see that, you know, big time crowds around are doing, you know, paying attention to this. So good for the Twins.
They throw a 1-minute parade and publicize it, and every news station called for that.
That was a classic, though. I'm not going to lie to you. I laughed about that when I read that it was parade would begin at 11:30 and was expected to end by 11:31. That was just a classic. So I know Sean has to be behind that somehow or another, and I just thought, wow, that's the real deal there. So
yeah, much like American Association games all summer, the parade lasted long and actually went 3 minutes instead of one.
So wow, they're way over the group there, so over the time allotted. So that is just too funny for sure. Okay, well, Kevin and I wanted to spend tonight just kind of recapping stuff that went on around the American Association this season and talk about highlights from the both of us and big things that are still going on in the league right now. So Kevin, why don't we just start with trades? A couple of big trades went down yesterday. Kansas City involved in those. The biggest one has to be the Mason Davis deal, if you ask me.
Right, because Mason Davis, if he does play in Milwaukee, you know, with these players we name later, yes, Davis is property of the Milwaukee Milkmen now, but that's only if he plays in the American Association. If he gets signed by a major league team, he be playing in the minor league, any minor league level, or if he wants to play Atlantic League, he can go play Atlantic League. So it doesn't mean it's etched in stone that his baseball career is headed to Milwaukee, but if it does, it's a nice cornerstone, I think, for the Milkmen to build their offense on. I think that's something they lacked, was a good bat at the top to get rid of that consistently got on and had speed and could play a great number of positions in the field. I just think Davis would be a good cornerstone for the team.
Well, he goes to Milwaukee as the completion of the TJ House deal. And, like you talked about, this is a guy that could hit almost anywhere in the order, who's great at getting on base, proved last season during the championship run of 2018 that, he's a guy that gets big hits, that makes big plays. And, for a team that needed a lot of hitting, because let's face it, hitting last year was totally the Achilles heel of the Milwaukee Milkmen. I thought this was an outstanding deal just because it adds a quality bat to that. And if they keep like an Adam Walker and a couple of those guys that hit for some power, he's a great table setter, Kevin.
Yeah, maybe we're kind of underestimating the knowledge of the Milwaukee baseball staff, because that was a very shrewd decision on their part to pick Davis. And, maybe I think what happens is they're kind of given a list of like four or five guys and they get to pick from that. So you have to think the previous manager would have made that list. So, maybe we're not giving the old manager enough credit.
Absolutely, absolutely. Also part of that, catcher Christian Correa traded to Texas, also to complete an earlier deal there. And Correa didn't have like a huge season offensively, Kevin, but boy, he sure handled that pitching staff well, and they responded to him. So for a team that's trying to develop young players from another country and helping them to become Olympic ready, I guess is the way to look at this. A good choice to have behind the plate to help them develop.
Yeah, he's got 8 months to learn Chinese, so we'll see if he gets going on that right away. Maybe he'll get one of those some audio books for Christmas that helps you learn a new language. But I tell you the kind of player Korea is. Kind of remembering a story Dan Baum told, like right after the end of the T-Bone season when they got eliminated from Sioux City. In the last game, the last two times at bat, Correa attempted bunts. And we found out later that I believe, and I don't know, Dan will correct me when he hears the show, I thought he was playing the last game with a broken hand. Catching, mind you, with a broken hand.
That's brutal.
Because, yeah, his backup was a rookie, so there was no way he wanted to come out. So that right there should tell you the kind of player that, or the kind of leader that Christian Correa is. And yeah, he's got a, I think he will be a tremendous addition to the AirHawks if he joins them.
We also have Adrian Marin traded from Winnipeg to Kansas City. Guy spent a little time on the disabled list this season, but was an outstanding shortstop for them. Made some incredible plays I watched this season. And so I think that, again, you lose a Mason Davis, but you come up with a guy who's, an incredible talent. And, it's like one of those things I look at, Kevin, and I just think Joe Calfa-Pietro always finds a way.
Right, he's not going to bring the batting average like Mason Davis does, but he can't argue with the glove. And boy, I tell you, a middle infield combo of Dylan Tice and Adrian Marin, yeah, I'll take that and go with it. So, yeah, nice pickup for the trade that the T-Bones had with Winnipeg.
Absolutely. Well, those are the major trades that have happened over, that we kind of have noticed in the last week, or since Kevin and I had our championship series go down. So we do want to kind of just spend a little bit of time talking about player performances this season, Kevin. First of all, we're just going to run through quickly this week in the Association of Minor League Sports Report. Choose Keon Barnum as the MVP of the American Association this season. No surprise, 31 homers, 90 RBI. Guy hit 311. It seemed like a lock for that spot, and the American Association agreed upon that as well. Manager of the year was Joe Calfapietra. That was kind of a split decision. There was actually five managers that got votes in that, and that should tell you what an outstanding year it was. Something Kevin has talked about quite a bit over the last couple of weeks, that there are a number of managers, five or six of them, that had clearly manager of the year credentials out there. So Joe just happened to be the guy who wound up winning for the second season in a row. Rookie of the year was Michael Hart out of Sioux Falls, who had an outstanding year for the Canaries. And the pitcher of the year, we wound up going with Mitch Lamson. Lamson was also the American Association pitcher of the year. Lamson in particular, I'm kind of interested about, Kevin. Well, actually, Barnum we can also talk about, too. I was thinking 31 homers, okay? Now, let's say you cut those numbers in half if he was at AA or AAA. I mean, even in a 140-game season, that's still like a 25-homer season. That seems like, a guy who should deserve a shot. I mean, am I wrong?
Well, the tough part is, every team's got, on every level, has that one big home run RBI guy in their lineup. So it's kind of tough for someone like a Barnum, because really he can play some first base and DH, and every team's already got that guy. So it just makes it really tough for Barnum to get back into an organization unless somebody is really sold on him and wants to give him a shot.
I guess I can see that. It just seems that with that kind of bat, I mean, and especially in the day and age we live in, where everybody wants to hit the home runs and they don't really care about a lot of strikeouts and stuff like that, he probably hit 270, maybe 280 or 285 at AAA somewhere. But if you could get a guy who had 22 or 23 home runs, that seems to me to just be a big deal. But, I don't know what his experiences have been like in affiliate ball, so maybe, he's gotten a few chances there, and then they just kind of decided that he's run his course there. But we saw, was it Travis Denker out of Laredo 3 years ago or so that got signed by San Francisco? The guy was like 31 years old at that point and got signed, a couple of months into the season. And I thought, well, if that guy's, Denker was awesome, not denying that for a moment, but I'm just thinking if he's worthy of signing at 30 or 31, I don't understand why Keon Barnum doesn't deserve a shot.
Well, I was told the book on Barnum right now is that there are some holes in his swing, and I thought in that crucial four-game series that Chicago had in St. Paul, that when St. Paul didn't pitch around Barnum and they actually went after him, they had some success. So I guess I didn't, the four games I saw, I guess I didn't see the Barnum that was terrorizing the rest of the league. So, you hope he gets a shot, but it's just a tough spot for a first base DH to try to crack an organization.
And I think you and I talked about the fact that after he hit that 30th home run, it was like a 2-week span before he got number 31. So, I guess there are spots out here where he's a streaky guy, and if that's not the kind of hitter you're looking for, well, then he's not your guy, I guess. So I get that. Mitch Lamson, though, Kevin, this is one I'm a little confused about. I understand he's 28 years old, but this is a guy who's just, proven himself to be a winner. In the Atlantic League, after leaving Winnipeg, being traded there at the end of the season, 3-0 with a 0.79 ERA. That's supposed to be the independent league that they always claim out there. And so I really guess I'm kind of at a loss for this guy who hasn't, he's just a couple of years away from being in AAA. So Lamson seems to be a guy who deserves a shot here.
Yeah, I would agree on it. It's, with starters, I guess Lamson doesn't have that 95 mile an hour fastball that's going to get scouts' attention. But the guy just finds a way to get guys out, and I think that parlays into any league out there. But yeah, it's the age thing, I don't know, it just kind of scares off some scouts. like just be a little more impressed with a guy that's 22, 23 years old and can throw 95, 96 miles an hour. But, you know, you just hope that maybe somebody will take a chance with Lamson. Especially, you know, if he's pitched that well in the Atlantic League, you know, maybe there's major league people out there checking the games out, maybe coming up with the next big rule change. Maybe they'll have it where, like, in the middle of innings next year in the Atlantic League, you got to run the third base first and go third, second, first, home. That'll be the next big innovation.
Well, in 22 innings, 22 and two-thirds innings in the Atlantic League, 11 hits, 2 runs, neither of them earned. Okay, so it really technically is zero ERA. Okay, 6 walks and 22 strikeouts. Now, again, this is supposed to be the elite independent league that everybody talks about. I mean, this guy is just dominating people. I guess too, the other thing that kind of jumped out at me was the lack of a 95 mile an hour fastball. Am I wrong? But it seems like left-handers are not held to the same standard that right-handers are about that. Am I wrong about that, or?
Yeah, because I think you're seeing a lot more, us watching MLB tonight, and they're boasting about all these left-handers that some were starters, some were not, but there's a lot of these left-handers coming out of the bullpen now throwing 95, 96 miles an hour. Like a guy like a Josh Hader in Milwaukee would be a prime example, though he doesn't quite get up to 95, but with this bullshit, it just looks a lot harder. But yeah, you're seeing a lot more hard-throwing lefties out there, where I think that's what scouts are aiming towards more. You know, they want the fireballer and not the Jamie Moyer. So,
well, let's kind of jump around the league here a little bit, Kevin, and let's start with the Texas AirHogs for a moment. At the moment, we're not really sure about what Chris Bando's status is going to be with the team. From my understanding, this is going to be left up to the Chinese government and the sponsor of the club that came over here. But, you know, this year three coming up here. So I would assume the expectations are going to be pretty high, not just for what Texas can produce, but that they're expecting these guys to be, you know, at least 4 or 5 of these guys to be solid performers in the American Association, if not more. So what should we expect Texas to be at least a 500 team next year, just because the expectations have to be high on them?
Not if they're going to be breeding ground for more Chinese players. I just don't think that you can instantly flip a switch and team 20, 25 games in the standings.
Well, that would be 22 for them to get to 500. What is year three now? And we only saw, I think, 4 guys that came from the 2018 team that carried over into 2019. So let's just say it's 8 guys that come next year. Is realistically 34 wins, 38 wins? What becomes a realistic factor? Will you still consider the team a success?
I think the team can become a success if you got domestic players around them. That, you know, if you're not depending so much on Chinese guys, if you got a pretty good domestic lineup that you're right now every night, you know, maybe a 45 wins isn't all that impossible. We saw towards the end the one Chinese pitcher took a no hitter into the 8th inning against the Milkmans. But frankly, gosh, it just seemed like the AirHogs were lacking a little bit for a support cast for the Chinese guys, and it's like the guys that did play well eventually got signed or traded away.
Yeah, you mentioned about Zhang Tao, and he is kind of an interesting situation to me, Kevin, because I look at this. Okay, we see a lot of pitchers now, and I believe it was Noah Syndergaard is one example to me, of guys who have decided to bulk up so they add more power to their game, and then they're not the same pitcher. I mean, Syndergaard has battled through a lot of injuries, which I think might be partially due from flexibility now, lack of flexibility, according to a lot of managers that have talked to me about this. This is a guy that, for Zhang Tao, who was 5'9", 170 or something, I think was the numbers on him. That's a guy who, if he's going to have any success, is going to have to add some bulk to him. So I'm interested to see if he does, how that affects him as a pitcher, and if that affects his ability to stay on the diamond.
Well, like Mark Hamburger always said, you can't break Gumby.
That's true. That's true. That may have to be the solution for him there. Because, you know, I would love to see this guy just have an amazing season next year. You know, I just am curious if they kind of teach him, look, you're going to have to add 20 pounds, 25 pounds to you. You know, what that means for him in the long run. So that'll be kind of interesting to watch, Kevin.
Well, you know, it is kind of interesting with the pitchers. I was looking at a situation with Liam Hendricks, Australian pitcher. I remember him breaking into the major leagues with the Twins in around 2012, 2013, and frankly, things didn't go well. He was a guy that threw like 91, 92, but he just didn't have the fastball to have any long-term success. But then it's like in the next few years, all of a sudden that 91, 92 was coming in at 96, 97 out of the bullpen, and now we see him as the closer for the Oakland Athletics. So, you know, it's weird with these players. If they find something, if they bulk up, or if they just find something in the mechanics where just like that, they can add on 3-4 miles an hour to the fastball, and they've went from being a suspect to a prospect.
You're absolutely right. Well, let's move on to Milwaukee. We already talked a little bit about the addition of Mason Davis. We're going to, at this point, some of that starting staff, we assume, will obviously be invited back. Angel Ventura, you figure, will be back next year. Jordan Kraus. I think that I'm not missing any. House was the other guy who went to Kansas City. But there's some quality pitching out there for this team. So right now it's just looking like the hitting aspect of it. And I realistically think, Kevin, that we're talking about at least three quality bats to that team for them being competitive next year.
Right. That's if their bats that they have now come back. But we really don't have a good read on routine field or whatever it'll be called next year, if it is indeed going to be a hitter's park or a pitcher's park. So I think once that's established, then, you know, like you saw with Montgomery and Sioux City, switching from power to a running team, I guess. You get the lay of the ballpark first, and then you kind of build your team around it. Do they need to be a power team? Do they need to be a team that's going to manufacture runs? So, frankly, I thought the ballpark kind of played big, especially in the power alleys. I thought you had to have a pretty good drive to get out of the ballpark. So, you might see, and especially with the field turf there, you might see Milwaukee have to become one of those teams that a lot of running, a lot of hit and runs, a lot of line drive hitters.
Well, you brought up the most interesting point about this team to me after the move happened. Oh, absolutely. After the move happened, which was when Anthony Barone, I'm assuming I'm saying Barone is correct, it was hired as the new manager there. They went from a guy who had no professional managing experience to a guy who had no professional managing experience. And
it was a lateral move.
Yeah. You know, and it's like, okay, so I'm assuming that the reason that Gary McClure did not stay was because ownership wanted more of a winner. Okay, well, if that's the case, then you should have hired a Doug Simonek from the start, or you should be hiring Doug Simonek right now. You know, I mean, I guess I'm not really understanding a kind of move like this where you hire another first-year manager for a team if your objective is to win.
And we don't know how available Doug Simonek is. I believe he was like a player personnel advisor for the Ottawa Champions this season.
Well, there's somebody out there that's got management experience and has had success in independent baseball. You know, Massarelli, guys like that. There's somebody out there. So if winning was your objective, it would seem that you would make a move to hire somebody who's won. Is that too logical?
Or maybe a coach off a team that's won too, that's
Exactly.
kind of learning the ropes from a successful manager.
So there are guys out there. I guess I'm just a little confused about the move here. And I know, and then a thing I talked about in the article that I'm just, kind of curious about your thoughts about is we've seen where, a couple of years ago in Fargo as an example, we've seen where a guy replaced a manager from the coaching staff. And the insinuation instantly is that guy drove out the manager. He kind of went behind the scenes, regardless whether it's true or not. And I don't believe that that was the case in Fargo. Okay. But there's always that insinuation. I think they put Barone in a really bad spot right off the bat.
Right. The expectations are going to be high that he's going to make the team a winner. And, maybe he's got it in him, but it just seems like a difficult spot for a guy with no American Association or independent baseball managerial experience to step in. You kind of wonder, I mean, a guy like Ole Sheldon, how many years has he coached under George Sampson? You'd have to think it.
2012, is that right? Since 2012 or
Yeah,
13?
you'd have to think, unless he's really happy doing what he's doing in St. Paul, you'd think maybe that's the kind of guy that you bring in, a guy that knows the ropes of the league and has connections, and that's a guy that could be a manager in this league. But I think he's pretty comfortable where he's at. But that's the kind of guy I think you look for is a guy that I think ought to get another shot in the American Association, even though he's very happy where he's at, is Mike Pinto. He's created a culture for the Southern Illinois minors, and it's amazing where, I mean, when he brings in players, it's like he is selling the minors like he is selling a college to them. And the players buy into it. And I just think Pinto, if he got the reins of Milwaukee and brought that kind of attitude to Milwaukee, I think he can make the Milkmen into a contender. But I think it's like you said too, there's other independent league veterans out there that you could bring in as a manager, where I don't think you need to be falling back on another rookie.
Yeah, especially if you're at a belief that your team can compete in the toughest division in the league. Four of the top five teams came out of this division record wise, and then you're deciding to go with another rookie. That seems like a pretty tough call to me, but we'll see. Kevin, let's move on to the Sioux Falls Canaries. Obviously, the team that probably was the biggest disappointment for me personally this season in terms of overall record where they finished at. I thought this was a team that was going to wind up battling to the end. The pitching staff just did not work out this season, and losses of Adrian Nieto and Taylor Hill wound up being huge. But let's just talk about the Nieto one here for just a moment, Kevin, because I think baseball to me, baseball is the sport where one guy has the least amount of impact, I guess, in my opinion. Okay, I mean, in basketball, if you lose your star player, you're sunk. But baseball, it seems like you can kind of bypass that. But boy, that sure seemed to not be the case with Sioux Falls this year.
No, I just don't think they were ready for that. It was a tough drop off when you go from major league veteran with Nieto to a kid that only had collegiate experience, and he was expected to catch every night. And like you said, you lose Taylor Hill, and eventually the Canaries were a very inexperienced staff, and they got to the point where they were just bringing in retreads that other teams were cutting, because frankly, into the season, there's just not a lot of pitching out there to go get. So it just became the perfect storm for a disastrous second half of the season for the Canaries.
One thing we've talked a lot about with this team is the struggles of the bullpen down the stretch. And we saw guys that I never thought would be closing in this league, to be honest with you. And I know that manager Mike Meyer was looking for anything that he could try to get to close out games. You've been to Sioux Falls on a lot of occasions. You've seen a lot of games there. I'm understand that's a very difficult ballpark to pitch in. So what do you do about that, I guess, is the question.
Well, like yeah, I think Meyer said to you, you gotta find the pitchers that are just can learn to accept that that's gonna happen. You're gonna get some wind-blown home runs, but are you managing the keep the mistakes to a minimum? Solo homer hurts you a lot less than if you walk two guys and then give up one. There have been pitchers that have went out there and had success. Their own pitching coach, Ben Moore, is one of the most successful pitchers in the entire American Association. If there's someone that should be teaching these guys how to pitch in the league, I think it would be Ben Moore.
That's a valuable point right there. And we did see Taylor Hill had a monster year there. It seemed that guys that were depended upon early to deliver just didn't. And Kevin, I think that kind of besides the Nieto loss, I thought that the biggest turning point for Sioux Falls was that series where St. Paul came to town, and there was like 60 runs. It was even more than that. It was a ridiculous amount of runs that was scored in those four games. Okay, and it just seemed that the pitching staff never rebounded after that. It was like we got battered and we just never got up.
Yeah, that just absolutely destroys your bullpen too when you're result, you know, it's choose your poison. Do you have your bullpen pitching 6, 7 innings every night, or do you ruin your starter's confidence by making them wear one, as we like to say, by giving up like 10 runs in 6 innings, but not taking them out because you really don't want to kill your pen.
That's
It's
a
just,
tough call. That's a tough call, Kevin.
yeah, it's just not healthy. And that was kind of the story of the season for the Canaries.
The two teams tied at 40 and 59, the Gary Southshore Railcats and the Lincoln Salt Dogs. It's interesting because I think these two teams could be talking the same story. We could be saying almost the same identical things about them.
Well, it was second year in a row that was a second half collapse for the Lincoln Salt Dogs, and it never really seemed like Gary got their wheels underneath them, so I guess in that way they kind of differ.
I think neither one of us expected them to be high up in the division. Gary, I had finishing in fifth. Lincoln, I had finishing in fifth. Lincoln surpassed that by finishing in fourth. But you and I talked about this quite a bit from the very start of the season about, and again, I have all the respect in the world for Bobby Brown. He has proven himself in this league. I just seen that there was one, a few moves too many that were made early on, and I guess I, you know, the thought for me was just team chemistry just seemed to be an issue here.
Right, he just it was kind of hard to tell how he was building his team. Was he building it around power? Was he building it around speed, pitching? It just wasn't really a lot of flow to what he was trying to establish, and they treaded water for a while, but boy, the last month of the year was just dreadful.
And you brought up a point here about Gary about a month ago that I think is a serious concern for them is that the league is attracting a lot of AAA guys, a lot of former major leaguers, a lot of high talent AA guys. And if Gary is no longer, I mean, if their goal is going to be to stick with these, 10, 12, 14 rookies to start out every year, can this team honestly compete in the American Association anymore?
You know, for one Tom Walraven, there's seven or eight guys that in the end just don't pan out. And I think with all the stuff going on in the Atlantic League, the consensus is that better players are going to be looking to play in the American Association. So if Tiger thought it was tough this year, it's just going to keep getting tougher. And I don't know if you think you got to conform, or eventually, you may have to make a tough decision.
Well, I came a year after this, but I'm understanding that Greg Taggart, it's only last 5 or 6 years that he's turned to these younger teams, that he actually used a lot of veteran guys before. I guess it's time to start looking at that option again, I would think.
Yeah, I would think so. You had a veteran guy here and there. Wilfredo Jimenez was just never really seemed to get on track with them this year, and eventually played well in Fargo. So he hasn't completely shut out picking up veterans, but he just seems like he's been very selective about who he has chosen. But still, it just seems like the dependence is on the younger guys. It seems like
Well,
he kind of almost wants to develop like a consistent roster where he can sign these guys as rookies, get a couple of years out of them as a rookie, and then that's where he gets his LS1s, LS2s are from guys that he's had in his system for a couple of years. And I just don't see where other teams are finding LS1s, LS2s that are much more talented than that.
and you are right about that because Colin Willis, Crosby, I even think Wilfredo Jimenez has been around had been around 3 or 4 years there in Gary. Lars Lagoria had been around a couple of 3 years. He definitely is looking to build a team that he could hang on to for a while. I other than Willis, who could be I think could be an MVP if he was in another team in this league right now. I just look at this team and I think that these guys aren't developing. I mean, Crosby is a fine guy, okay? But this is your first baseman who's hitting, 280 with 5 home runs. And I'm your first baseman. Okay, that's just not that's not a it seems to me that's not a formula for big success. Now maybe I'm wrong, Kevin, but that just doesn't seem like the way you're going to wind up winning championships when that's your guy.
No, it's not healthy. And that ballpark doesn't do many favors either.
Well, that's true. And you have a great point about that as well. And I guess, then you look at kind of a Sioux City model that isn't having guys that hit a bunch of home runs, but you're looking to steal and gets, use your speed. But I don't think we've seen that as much with Gary the last couple of years. And this team's looking to get back into a championship form. You got to start running more, I would think.
Right, yeah, it does kind of seem to be their MO when things are going well that they're like, guys are sitting in the past are just like little gnats biting at you. And just didn't really seem like it seemed like Gary kind of lacked the bite for a good part of the season this year. You saw it in the game, every once in a while where it's like, okay, yeah, they're playing real cat ball now, but it just wasn't often enough for them to even sniff being a contender in the North Division.
Well, let's move on to the Winnipeg Goldeyes, finished 57-43. Kevin, next year we're going to see a fairly different Winnipeg Goldeyes team.
Well, I think it's different enough in which you look at, when we're beginning the season, we were talking about Reggie Abercrombie and Josh Omanski as being like the Kirby Puckett, Kent Hrbek of the Goldeyes franchise, and we're going to go in the next season, and neither one of them will be in Winnipeg. So that'll be interesting right there. I think Rick Forney's got some nice pieces to build around. Got a feeling that as long as they want to come back, that guys like Mitch Lamson and Victor Capion
Kevin
will
McGovern.
be. Yeah, McGovern will be in the fold, but gotta wonder what I'm sure the cast around them is gonna look a bit different next year.
You were talking about a few weeks ago about fans were getting a little grumbly, I guess is the word we'll say, about where the team has been the last couple of years, and I wonder if that puts pressure on Rick Forney to feel like he has to deliver something big. And so, does this? I would think, does Winnipeg jump into the free agent market, really early on, November, early December, really trying to have 18, 20 of their guys already on the roster by that point?
Well, I think the core guys you probably want to have wrapped up by then, but I don't think you really want to have your whole roster filled up because you're always going to get those guys that get released during MLB spring training that you'll want to add on. And I don't think it sends a good message to the players if you're going into training camp and you got all these guys that don't know what their status is going to be. So, especially if you're having to go play in Winnipeg and to deal with the cold up there, you kind of want to have some reassurance that going into training camp, that barring an unlikely ordeal, that you're going to be making the team. You don't want to be a non-roster invitee trying to crack the roster.
Well, let's talk about the 27 Yankees, the Cleveland Railroaders, also finishing at 57-43, losing out in the playoff chase on the last day of the season. Kevin, there's a lot of things we could talk about this particular team. So I'm just going to say, Kevin, go.
Well, there is a lot of talent on the team, and I'm not just doing this to be funny, but there is a lot of talent on that team. And here's what I probably talked about on the show before. They went into St. Paul, and they got into St. Paul like 3 or 4 days before the series even began. Those players were so keyed in to that three-game series in St. Paul that started right after the All-Star break. They went up there knowing that it was going to be 7,000-8,000 people every night, and they played like it was their playoffs. And there's the results. They swept the Saints. They go into Chicago, take 2 of 3. But then it just seemed like they blew their load right there. It was like after that, it just went downhill from there. So I think what you're going to need to see out of Cleburne is a little more slow and steady winning the race, because as good as they were in St. Paul and Chicago, they went back home and there was a series where they got swept by the Air Hawks. So all the good you did in St. Paul, you just neutralized by laying an egg against the worst team in the league. So, I mean, you get the fate you deserve. And I guess it just wasn't that magic left to the Railroaders when they went on the last road trip to Lincoln and Fargo, where everything was pretty much laid out for them. They knew how many they had to win to get in the playoffs, and if they would have won exactly those many games that they were in, but they just did not get the job done. But the talent is there. I really like that lineup. Robertson, or, oh, geez, Zach Naryer, John Nestor. I mean, there's talent there, but something just was not clicking for the last couple weeks of the season.
Kevin, let me preface this by saying there's no person out there with a greater amount of respect for Brent Cleveland than myself. Okay, I've been around this guy for 6 years now, and classiest guy that there is, just a great baseball guy, phenomenal, phenomenal human being. Okay, everything about this, I would say this guy's just a great guy. I'm just wondering though. He takes over a Wichita Wingnuts team in 2018. They finish just out of the playoffs. And then this year, he goes to Cleburne and they finish just out of the playoffs. And how much responsibility then does the manager have when you have a team with that much talent and you don't win?
Well, it's a tough call, and I guess we're not in the locker room. We're not seeing what's going on. We're not seeing if guys are quitting on him. I hope that's not the case, but I mean, that is kind of a little irony right there that the same story played out 2 years in a row. And we were talking about the Milwaukee managerial situation. Well, this is Brett Cleveland's first professional managerial experience too. So I'd say, you know, if it's the same script in 2020, then yeah, you start doubting, what's going on with the manager, but let's let that play out.
Yeah, and actually, just kind of sidebarring here for a moment. If you're going back to Milwaukee for a moment, if you're a team looking for a winning manager, why wasn't Pete Rose Jr. considered there? That's another guy I would be kind of curious about. You know, he only won 125 games in 2 years in Winnipeg. I mean, in Wichita, I mean, you know, went to the championship twice. So, you know, there's other options out there. But where was
he this year?
At home taking care of his kids. So, you know, just
really?
Being dad. Yeah,
wow.
Being dad this season. So, back at Cleveland, I'm kind of perplexed from this point. And so I'm going to, cause this is something that I've already told myself that I'm going to be different about with Josh Robertson, from now on. Because for years, when I first became associated with him in Wichita, I listened to him tell me every year about how terrible his team was. You know, it could have been 70-29 at a point or something, and he would be, you know, we're here, we're not good, we're not good here, we're not, you know, we have bad parts here, we have bad parts there. And I don't think he was saying that just to be negative. I think he was constantly looking at the flaws in his team. Okay, and that's why they were so good. Okay, I think the last couple of years, he's gotten a little comfortable with his team and has been really excited. He's let his excitement defray against his seeing flaws. And I thought to myself, okay, well, I'm not going to listen to his good things anymore. I'm going to tell him, you know, well, there's these flaws too, because I thought that's really what gave him that edge, you know, was to make, if his outfielder was hitting 270, he was looking for somebody that hit 300. You know, that wasn't just good enough in Wichita. And so I'm curious how this affects Josh this offseason, if he feels compelled to, you know, is it go for broke now? Is it I need to do something different? Is it I did everything right and things just didn't work out? I mean, if you're in his spot, what do you feel right now, Kevin?
Well, I think the only spot that there was a noticeable weakness with Cleburne was the bridge from the starters to the closer, Tyler Wilson. Wilson was, well, as good as he could ask for, but Nefi Ogando, a major league veteran, he didn't pan out as a starter, and he had some success in the bullpen, but he also, I feel, kind of let them down in the last few weeks, too, so I think he may be a little more aggressive this time around in establishing a better bullpen.
And I think you're hitting on one of the keys, because last season's Wichita team, you know, there was a lot of expectations about that bullpen group. And then there was early in the season, the guy who was supposed to be their main setup guy had gotten hurt in an automobile accident, and James Campbell didn't come back from an injury as quickly as they thought, and that bullpen all of a sudden started to have problems, and things didn't really work out as well for them. And I think you're right on the button here with the bullpen just did not deliver for them, and that cost them probably 8 games this season. You know, and watching out there, there's your division.
Yeah, but they won 4-6 against St. Paul. I saw the. The little news article today where they made sure to point that out, that against the league champions it went 4-2. So,
well, that's great news when you're trying to console yourself for not advancing. But okay, Sioux City Explorers, Kevin, let's talk about them. They start out, and you mentioned this last week, that this was a team that we were thinking, you know, maybe there was just the hangover of the letdown from last season was not going to be a team that could really compete. And boy, you know, they caught fire in July and into early August and made a nice run for the playoffs this season. It obviously wasn't as good as the 2018 team, but in some ways I thought it was better. So your thoughts on Sioux City and what you saw out of them this year?
Well, we were writing the eulogy in May and we were plotting out the parade route in July. So It was a unpredictable season for the Explorers, but I think in the end, what got them was a lack of production at the bottom of the order. I thought there was a little bit of a drop off this year with a guy like a Jose Cermal, and once again, I think Montgomery's going to be second guess for letting Michael Wang go to St. Paul.
I think you're right about that. I also wonder for them for next year, how much does Jose Cermal have left? How much are you going to get out of Nate Sampson? This guy's been a 300 plus hitter for what, since 2016, 15. He's I think 31 now. How many years does he have left that he can keep giving to Sioux City, or wants to give to keep giving to Sioux City? So, could we see a massive overhaul of this roster by next season?
Yeah, well, that's obviously up to the veterans on the team. I think Sampson and Cermal, ball's going to totally be in their court whether they want to be back or not. I know, as we saw during the All-Star break, Sampson's got a little at home now, so gotta wonder at what point will he be looking to get on with the next chapter of his life. But if they come back, that just, it's once again, got a solid 1-2 punch with those guys. But yeah, they just seem like they're lacking in some spots this year. As we were saying in the last episode, first base, you relied on Adam Sasser, and he just didn't get you the production like he got in the past from a guy like a Dean Green. So I think, other than your core players, yeah, I can see a little bit of a reload for Steve Montgomery.
I think Dylan Kelly was kind of a late sign for them, was looking at other options for himself in the off season, and so he may not be back next year. I figure that that starting staff in particular is going to see a massive overhaul. I would assume a Pete Toggle would earn a shot to get back an affiliate ball somewhere with how well he pitched. And I don't know about where Taylor Jordan's situation would be out of this year. Eric Karch could be, hanging it up if he really felt compelled to, I guess, his point. And so I think we're going to see an entirely new Sioux City Explorers pitching staff, and probably 8 or 9 of those guys could be brand new next year. I that wouldn't surprise me, Kevin.
Yeah, I can see Montgomery once again bringing in a lot of pitchers into his training camp and whittling it down from there. Seems to be his MO lately.
Well, Kansas City T-Bones finished in the top of the South Division at 58-42. Kind of a surprise run there at the end, to the third place team heading into the weekend, the last weekend of the season, and wind up winning the division. It's just, I thought this team, I think, and I hate to use excuses, Kevin, but I think this would have been a 65-win team had it not been for the weather early on.
Yeah, that played a big part of it, and it just didn't allow them to get into much of a groove. And it also may have. I thought their bugaboo this season was the middle relief corps. The starters weren't getting them deep enough in the games, and when the relievers are coming in, they weren't throwing strikes. I mean, you had a decent closer with Carlos Diaz at the end. Even he had a little issue with control, but I just thought her just staff just gave up way too many free passes. And I think eventually Joe had a pretty good rotation down there, but I think the injury bug hit them too, losing the guy like Christian Binford was becoming really good with them, and he got injured. So you didn't have him for the stretch drive, and Mason Davis was hurt for a good part of the end of the season. Tried to play through it, but you could just tell that he wasn't feeling 100%. So, yeah, I think the doubleheaders, ineffective arms in the bullpen, and injuries at the end prevented Casey from repeating as champs.
One guy I don't think we've talked about all season long, that I think his absence was a big blow to Kansas City, was Noah Parrio Jr. I mean, when he came to Kansas City last year, the guy was ridiculous for them and was a huge factor in that championship series as well. And I wonder if it's that guy that you just knew was going to come up with big RBI that they just didn't have this year. And that was the reason that they just couldn't get themselves rolling.
Right. It just wasn't that one guy that just would get on this incredible hot streak and carry a club for a while. I was saying they had a lot of good players, but there wasn't that. And then, you know, that should tell you that right there. You know, they talked down there about how, well, they didn't have a player of the week or all season. Well, that should tell you because you didn't really have a guy that was like, that got on a hot streak and carried a team where you'll get league-wide recognition. So there are a lot of good players, but I think they were just lacking that player that just would get on fire for a month and carry the team.
I think you want to know that you have a balanced team that you could get production from everywhere. But I think what this showed, and St. Paul showed this too this season with the way Brady Shoemaker played in the last month and a half, that there has to be a guy you expect on. I expect to be the big deliverer of stuff, and there clearly wasn't that guy in Kansas City.
No. Towards the end, you had your two major league veterans get hot with Daniel Nava and Chris Colabello, but both of them kind of struggled to find their game when they were signed by the T-Bones originally. So, yeah, I mean, there were guys with potential. They just nobody managed to get that big breakout month and carry the club.
Moving to the Chicago Dogs, finishing third in the North at 59-41. An impressive turnaround from this team, a 17-win improvement, I think, from 2018. I'm going to give that exact number here in a moment to make sure I'm saying it right. But, you know, 2018 was a season where this team just could not hit very well. And then this year, they would 14-game win improvement, I'm sorry, where, man, they had two MVP candidates, Kevin.
Well, I don't know if we talked about it or somebody else did, but I think with Chicago, they found out what kind of park they got and they catered their team towards it. They found out after the first year that it was going to be a hitter's park, so they went out and got guys that could hit the ball in the ballpark. They may not be the fleetest of foot, but you don't have to beat out the ball if it flies over the fence.
Yeah, I think, what is it, 285 down one line and 215 down the other. It's something kind of small. So you have to figure that's a great ballpark to hit in. May not be 215. That sounds a little short, but
no, I could hit one out at 215.
But it isn't very much though. Yeah, I know, and I know that because they built it off the highways that are surrounding it or something, and so it's a great hitter's park for sure. You know, but What I found so exciting about the Chicago Dogs, man, we were talking about Luke Westfall early on in the season. The guy had three starts and hadn't given up a hit in any one of those starts and didn't give up a run through May. And, but it was all of a sudden this team was right in the race of everything. And it looked like they were going to overtake even, St. Paul after dominating those series against Gary. But, you could tell this team is just one step away from being a division contender right now. Just one more thing has to happen, it looks like, Kevin.
Right, yeah, they were right on the cusp of it, and frankly, I thought at times that they were going to pass St. Paul and maybe even Fargo, but just didn't quite materialize. But like you said, quite a bit of improvement from year one.
Well, if they keep on that pace, there'll be a 73-win season next season. So we'll see if that winds up coming out there. Fargo-Moorhead, Kevin, both of us predicted that they would be playoff teams. I think both of us had them winning the division, fell a game short of that, which is nothing to be, you know, losing sleep over, it sounds like. But manager Jim Bennett did a great job in his first year. So let's just start with that. So this is a team that a couple of months away from the season getting underway, their manager goes to take a job in affiliate ball, and you bring in Jim Bennett. And, you know, he proved to be a lot more than just a good manager. He proved to be just kind of a calming influence on the entire organization.
Yeah, he did. You didn't hear a bad word about Jim Bennett from anybody up in Fargo. And I just think he just kind of, you know, for that area of the country, I just think he just fit right in. I just seemed like an all-around good guy to have around, and I just think that reflected in his ball club.
A lot of great guys in this season, Kevin. Carell Prime, again, could have easily been the MVP this year with the fantastic job that he did after signing with the club. This is still, to me, the deepest team, the best team on paper.
Right. I just don't think, though, you can measure how much losing TJ Bennett and then Yoshan Medina affected this ball club. You look at the game five against St. Paul, that ball that Pena lifts his glove up too early on, you know Medina has, and that's possibly a double play and innings over. So you just can't measure how much the retirement and the injury affected this Fargo ball club.
And the loss of Daniel Comstock, you know, in the span of a week, they lost three guys from their starting lineup. And, you know, I know it's not right to be out there and talking about, well, what could have been. But I think if those three guys are still there, at least two of those guys, you know, Bennett still retires and they keep Medina and Comstock, those injuries don't happen. They're the American Association champions. And they win the division.
In game four, too, there's a ball that Joe Beck, granted it was an infield single, but you got to wonder if an experienced third baseman like Leo Pena makes a play on it. But you know what? Their injuries, every team has them. And I thought, too, that there was a good lineup for Fargo, but I just felt like there was also a lack of depth where once these guys went down, they just didn't really have the suitable replacements ready to take over.
You called that right. St. Paul Saints, Kevin, 15 years since they won the last championship there. When the season began, both of us had them finishing in second, I believe, in this division. They wound up winning the division. The first time the team had the best record in the league in quite some time. So let's start with this, Kevin, because this is a team that easily could have gone down the toilet. You have the two of the guys with the best ERAs in the league. The guy with the top ERA in the league, and Nick Belzer. Spencer Jones is under two, and then they're gone. And then Dustin Crenshaw signs to play in Mexico. And it's like three-fifths of your rotation is gone. And Eddie Medina is kind of battling through an arm problem. And this could have seriously gone sideways for them. But somehow or another, this team found a way to win.
Yeah, you had a pitcher like Jake Mathis. They're still trotting out every so often with an ERA well over five, approaching six. Benji Waite was brought in during the year. He didn't work out. I mean, it was just a state of constant flux in the Saints rotation, but I think you got to give them credit for it. Guys like Landon Beck and Jordan Jess, Ryan Zimmerman. Well, Zimmerman ended up being a starter a lot of the season, but Jess and Beck, they didn't complain. They stepped into the rotation, they got stretched out, and it provided a lot of stability for the Saints pitching staff towards the end of the season. Granted, you know, they weren't up in the leaderboards as far as ERA or strikeouts or wins, but they understood their role and they went out and did their jobs. And Dina gave it everything he had, and Zimmerman, for as still classified as a rookie, ended up having a pretty decent season.
The one guy I had a lot of respect for out of that team was Jeremy Martinez. Now, he replaces Justin O'Connor, who, I mean, kind of became a legend in St. Paul in that one season just because of his prowess behind the plate. But he also, you know, hit 17 homers and really was having quite a year there in St. Paul. And, man, Martinez really stepped into a tough spot and really did an outstanding job. I thought, you know, he made himself the top catcher in the league this year.
Right. Heck, we almost went into training camp without even one catcher on the Saints roster, much less a guy that ended up being an all-star like Jeremy Martinez was.
Yeah, I don't know if we talked about this directly on the show, but you think about it, this was, I think, the last guy signed by this club heading into spring training, and he winds up being an all-star. I mean, I can't imagine what the season would have been like without him. He didn't have, the biggest numbers, didn't have, have a lot of hoopla around him, but in a lot of ways, I thought this guy would have proved himself to be the MVP this season, Kevin.
A guy that I think should get some credit too, that's going to be an unsung hero, is Mike Aiello. He was a bullpen catcher for quite a bit of the year, but he got his chance to play, and he played well enough to get the trust of George Samus, which allowed Martinez to get some valuable days off or nights where he was just playing first base and not having to catch. And it seemed like that rejuvenated Martinez for the last 2 or 3 weeks of the season, where there were some stretches where I felt like he carried the Saints offense. So, just that one rookie doing his job just makes a veteran that much better. But so I think sometimes it goes unnoticed, but to me it didn't. So I think you got to give a little credit to Mike Aiello for allowing Martinez to get a badly needed breather when he needed to late in the year.
Well, here's an interesting question for you, Kevin. After the 2018 season, manager Joe Calfavicius down there in Kansas City pretty much rebuilt that team, a championship team. I think four or five guys stayed off of that club, might even been less than that, to the 2019 team. Could we see that big a transformation in the 2020 St. Paul Saints?
I don't think so. I think George Samus is very loyal to his players, and I think as long as it works out with the salary cap and the player classifications, I think pretty much anyone that would like to come back is more than welcome to. And yeah, it's going to be a different cast, but I think you might see a lot of the same guys back for trying to make another run at it. So yeah, it'll be interesting. That's a tough part about independent baseball. I was kind of thinking of that when I was watching, when I was with the team across the street at Birch's on Saturday night after they won the championship. I just thought, you know what? These guys are celebrating, but do they also realize that this is going to be the last time that they're all going to be together as a group? And that's just the nature of independent baseball, that every year it's a same show, but a different cast.
Boy, that's the truth. And again, I wouldn't be surprised to see some of those guys, Brady Shoemaker, decide, maybe it's time. He got what he was looking for. He's 32 years old, and maybe it's time to kind of hang it up there. And I'm wondering how long Mike Devine and Eddie Medina keep, giving it a shot there. It will be interesting to see how much of that team winds up remaining.
It was kind of a neat moment on Monday after the little rally they had after the 3-minute parade. I was standing outside the ballpark, talking with Eddie Medina for a bit. I go, "Well, Eddie, this just kind of bookends the season. You and I were the last ones around on media day sitting in the dugout talking, and now we're the last two standing outside here talking." So this kind of seemed to be an appropriate way to end the season.
Well, Kevin, the Saints weren't the only independent team to win a championship this year. So let's talk a little bit about others there. In the Pecos League, the Alpine Cowboys, which I did not know there was an Alpine Cowboys in the Pecos League, but they wind up being the champions there. So congratulations to them. The 10th season of Pecos League baseball, by the way. So we wanted to give them a big congratulations. In the Pacific Association, the San Rafael Pacifics win. That's kind of interesting to us because Gabe Suarez, former Joplin and Cleburne manager, is the owner there, and his dad is actually the field manager. They win the championship. So that was kind of interesting, Kevin.
Well, Joplin blaster pride there, boy.
So, kind of exciting, I actually thought that Gabe was managing that team this year, but according to them, it's his dad. So, congratulations, Oscar. That is awesome. The second at the fifth overall championship, I think they said for the San Rafael Pacific. So, congratulations to them. The Frontier League, their champion, Kevin, is a team that's not even going to be in the league next year.
Yeah,
It's
isn't
River
that
City.
something? River City Rascals win a fifth and deciding game. Wow. Kind of strange that you're going to have a league champion that doesn't even get a chance to defend the championship.
That is kind of crazy to me. I mean, as kind of looking around the American, the independent baseball champions this year, I don't really know much about the Alpine Cowboys, but there's an interesting story behind every team that won this year. And that leads us into the Can-Am League, Kevin, where there's an interesting story around New Jersey as well.
Right, just like the St. Paul Saints, the New Jersey Jackals won the championship for the first time since 2004, defeating the Sussex County Miners. And I believe that was game four of their series. I was kind of watching that on and off on Saturday night while catching the Saints game, and it was New Jersey held on for dear life. Sussex County had bases loaded and one out in the ninth inning, and New Jersey bore down and got the last two outs, and the celebration was on. And the irony being that New Jersey was the last team that George Sampson managed before he joined St. Paul. So, the guy, I got to imagine, probably had a little smile on his face was Joe Calpietra, whereas good friend George won the American Association title and his old team won the Can-Am title.
Yeah, Joe had, I think, four or five straight trips to the Can-Am League Championship Series and did not wind up winning that. So, I mean, they've been the runner-up for, I think, six or seven times since 2004. So, you know, nice to finally get that monkey off their back, I'm sure.
Well, if the rumors, not really rumors, but if we do see some kind of a merger between the Can-Am and the Frontier League, I guess you could say New Jersey would be the defending champion of that league, since the other champion would no longer exist.
That would be at least they feel like somebody is defending the crown, you know, instead of
right.
against the unknown. So that would be a winning combination, I'm sure, for the league to think that. So we kind of know that that's a possibility of these two leagues combining, but more details about that we don't really know, if they're going to be the front am league or what. I'm not really sure how that is, but that looks like that's going to be a good possibility that those two leagues combine.
Right, and it's just so hard for the Can-Am to find new markets to try to expand to. I guess there is a rumor of one this week, and we'll see if that materializes. Right now, Old Orchard Beach or someplace like that, I have no idea where it even is. But yeah, with River City dropping out, and who knows who else will, I just think it's just best for business, I think, for those leagues to come to an agreement on your salary cap and your player classifications and just make one big league out of it and go from there.
Well, the 2019 season is over, but it's not over for Kevin and I, because over the next 12 weeks, we will be bringing in the play-by-play guys from each of the teams to give you a little, let them talk about what was going on, for Kevin and I kind of pick their brains and see what were highlights and other thoughts they had about their team during the season. So we'll be starting with Tim Costello next week. Kevin, before we head out, any final thoughts on the 2019 season before we start addressing the individual teams?
It was a blast. I've never been so engrossed into a baseball season like I have with the 2019 American Association season. I found myself on nights where I was attending games from other leagues, but I was at a Northwoods League game, if I was at a Major League game. I was there, but my mind and eventually my phone were focusing on American Association. And it was just such a good year just to bury yourself into it and get involved and follow everything that's going on. It was just a really fun overall season.
I think I'm going to take credit for corrupting you and making it so that you're a whole league guy now. You're not just a follower of the Saints. You're in for the whole league now.
Yeah, you're sitting there in your ivory tower in Wichita while I'm out there on the road wherever, so.
Ivory tower. Wow. Well, okay, well, I don't think I would describe it that way, but no, I'm excited that you were, you know, this is our third year of doing the show, and we had a lot of kind of transformations of how the show has been done, and the show has really changed quite a bit. But I think the biggest change out of that has been that you've got to really get more involved in everything that's going on around the league. You know, you were kind of known as the St. Paul Saints guy, but now everybody knows you as Tevin Lucco this week in the association. So that's awesome. So,
you know, I talked to Derek Scherer, the Saints general manager, at the celebration, and he had some nice words to share with me. But, you know, the thing he said, he goes, "I know you're in media." And I was like, wow. In a way, that was cool. But in another way, I'm like, I just said, Derek, whatever media I am, I still live and die by this team. I'm just as much of a Saints fan as I was in day one. It's just that I just happen to know a lot more about what's going on in the rest of the league than I did before. But, yeah, I thought it was kind of interesting.
See, I love to hear that, because your first one of the first things you kept saying to me when you would come up is, you know, you didn't feel you belonged or anything like that. And I thought that's just silly, you know. But now I know you recognize that you belong up there. You're as much as a part of what's going on in terms of media around the league as anybody else, probably more so. And so I'm glad you're recognizing that now. So,
and hey, I belong during the playoffs, because every game that was played at CHS Field, there was somebody there from either screening for a newspaper or covering for their actual newspaper, that there were so many college hockey guys there. So I fit in just beautifully. We had a lot of stuff to talk about.
Well, that's encouraging. That's encouraging to know. Well, we're going to wrap up for tonight, but remember that next Thursday.
Well, I do have
go ahead. A final thought.
You know, well, a little bad news, potentially. You know, as teams wrap up their season, you find out that guys are playing hurt, and guys are going to have to go in for a little operations here and there. And I just got myself, I've been playing injured. I just got diagnosed today with torn meniscus in my left knee. I guess we're going to try to rehab it for a while, and if that works out, great. If not, then I will be going under the knife. But everything's going to be just fine, and it'll be during the off season, so I'll be better than ever by next year.
Well, we know that things will work out for you there, and we'll have you running the bases in no time. The rehab is on, if necessary.
And I'll tell you what, if I give you a little story from the last time I had surgery on the same knee. You know, there's ways to do it. You can get put under for the surgery, or you can do this thing called spinal block, where you're numb from the waist down. Well, I chose numb from the waist down. I didn't want to be put on. I never have been. I didn't really want to be. I had a lot of surgery. Well, after the surgery, the Novocaine wears off, except in one very important spot. I can remember this back when I had my last surgery. I was like, you know what? I ain't leaving here until I got feeling where I need feeling the most. So we'll hope that goes a little smoother this time around. But like I said, hopefully I won't need surgery at all. But, yeah, there's been a little hitch I might get along lately. It's from years of wear and tear at my paying job. So what we need to do is find a way where I can make this my main job and not have so much stress in my body.
I think that sounds like a good plan for this off season. And I did want to say that there have been people about me who have been saying for quite a number of years that I've been numb from the waist up for a long time. So just want to throw that out there as a last thought for this week. So,
well, you know, I had a lot of people asking me about you. It was like, well, what's going on with Rob? And, you know, we heard a little bit about the shoulder, so what's the latest on your shoulder?
They were able to break out a lot of the whatever is built up in a shoulder. I don't want to tell you truthfully, I still don't know how this happened. It's not like I had a repetition motion like throwing or something. I talked to both Steve Montgomery and George Samus about this, and both have told me they had frozen shoulders at points, and it's from the repetition of throwing all the time. And I don't have that, I don't know where this one thing came from, but they wound up breaking out where this buildup is around the joint, and it is significantly better. I still don't have as much range in reaching behind me as I had before, and I have to keep working on that. But there was a point where I could not, if I was lifting my arm out to the side, I could almost reach shoulder height, and that was about as far as I was going. And so now I can go back over my head and do all the stuff that I need to do. So just behind my back is really where I got to work on, and my wife is being generous and helpful and making sure that happens. So we're getting there, Kevin. We're getting there. So
So you see there, folks, you got both of us playing injured.
that's right, that's
And
right.
we're
Both of
still
us need
cranking
help.
out content.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the day that they had me under to break apart my shoulder, I was on the air with you that night. So see, I didn't let that get in the way. So playing hurt, Kevin. Well, Kevin and I will be back with you next Thursday as we welcome Tim Costello back to the show. So for Kevin, I am Rob Panier, and we will see you next time on This Week in the Association.